This sermon is given in honor of Arnold Cohen. Without him, you would be hearing an old holiday sermon. We would probably have had to give a Rosh Hashanah sermon today because he cued me into a wonderful idea. After Minyan on Monday, we were talking about the movie The Big Chill. I don't recall the context that began the discussion. Who remembers who played the dead body, the deceased friend in The Big Chill? Does anyone know this bit of movie trivia? Cut from the movie. No, I think it's not Kevin Bacon? Oh, I thought it was Kevin Bacon. That's the way I remember. I remembered it being Kevin Bacon. He sounded right. It's definitely a Kevin. That doesn't affect, thank God it doesn't affect the sermon in any way. That would be horrible to plan a whole sermon around the career of Kevin Bacon and realize you had nothing. Nothing to do with the sermon, thank God. Wow, that would have been dangerous. So this requires repeating a couple of lines in the movie that are maybe a little bit spicy, but not too spicy for this group of adults. I don't recall why Arnold brought up this great scene, but I looked it up and I remembered it fondly. So there's a character named Michael, played by Jeff Goldblum, and a character named Sam Weber, played by Tom Berenger, whose career is long since deceased, but he was a wonderful actor in the 80s. So Michael says, I don't know anyone who could get through the day without two or three juicy rationalizations. They're more important than sex. And Sam Weber's character says, oh, come on, nothing's more important than sex. And Jeff Goldblum's character responds, yeah, you ever go a week without a rationalization? So there's all sorts of rationalizations we give, most of them. You can do crazy making where you tell other people they're wrong, even though you know they're speaking truth. You can do rationalizations through hyper-intellectualization of things. In fact, that's one of my peeves when Jewish teaching becomes just an exercise in hyper-intellectual rationalization of things rather than a quest to get at some deeper truth or some spiritual meaning. A very common one, I've seen this before for Jews and for Christians, and probably exists no less for Muslims and Buddhists, is to rationalize through your religion. You know, that Jesus told me that he wanted me to do this, or I'm a good Jew, there's no way I could also be a gambling addict, or I'm a good Jew, I'm sure this is a legal relationship I'm having outside of my marriage. Religion has a way of providing us with many rationalizations, so how do you go a week without rationalizations? That's really the challenge. Let's look at a few rationalizations, I would say, within this week's parasha. So one of the things we're told in Deuteronomy 24, right at the beginning of that chapter, is when you take a wife and you marry her, and then you find something you don't like in your eyes, ervat davar, which in various places might mean untoward or something unseemly about her, you find something that's displeasing. You write her a sefer, a book of divorce, and you hand it to her, and she goes home, which is interesting. One of those interesting moments in our Torah, we have the laws for divorce, but none of the laws for marriage. So to consider this in the context of rationalizations, I want to share with you a Mishnah on it. What would be an ervat davar in marriage? I mean, is it having different tastes in music? Or is it having something deeply and morally fundamentally different? Or maybe different strategies of raising children? Or a horrible scar that you can't seem to get over? I mean, it could be a broad range of things, at least by the Hebrew meaning. And the Mishnah says that Shammai says one should not divorce his wife unless you found her guilty of unseemly conduct. And I think that probably means extramarital affair or something immoral. And Beit Hillel said, you can divorce her even if she spoils your food. And Akiva says, you can just divorce her if you find another woman more beautiful than she. So what's interesting is there are a couple ways to read this. You know, as I pointed out before, our Torah is written in a misogynist era. It's written in an era of gender difference. And as we evolve past those times, there are remnants still with us, and we can't deny them. But our sages, later sages, both even in the Mishnah, but later with the Torah Tamima, who is Baruch Epstein of 1902, they tried to make it sound better. So Baruch Epstein, writing in the Torah Tamima, says, this is the ease of divorcement that Akiva and Hillel offer. That is, you know, if you spoiled her food or if you just thought she wasn't beautiful enough and there was someone else who walked down. I hear that's what happens to Leonardo DiCaprio on a regular basis. So. It's for the protection of Jewess's virtue, that a female Jewess should be protected in her virtue. And it's a very interesting argument, but again, a hyper-intellectualization of something that's in its root somewhat painful. The fact that The single mitzvah we get about family life is only about divorce, and it's only divorce that goes one way. But I do want to share with you my own teacher's analysis of the Torah, Tumim, and the Mishnah. So we would think it might be more rude to divorce someone over burned soup, or there's a Yiddish expression, something like, if you don't like the soup, you should get divorced, because if you can't handle that, you know, where are you in your marriage? But the point that the Torah Tamima and my Rabbi Dan Shevitz are making is that Hillel and Akiva, who seem to offer much more lenient reasons one could divorce, actually give benefit to the woman, because if the only reason you could get divorced was for moral turpitude, that would mean that any divorced woman would never be remarriageable, that her life would be forever ruined, because one would assume, had she been divorced, it was over some ethical failing. Okay, fair enough, but a kind of rationalization we find in our lives, in marriage, in the Mishnah and the Torah. We can poke holes at anyone we love and find a reason to divorce, find a reason to struggle, find a reason to break a friendship or to leave a congregation or to point to something that doesn't work at our practice or our work and say, I'm going to break this relationship. I'm going to leave the university. I'm going to leave the lab over some small slight, you know, Jerry Seinfeld-esque, where in Seinfeld he always used to break up with women over, you know, she had big toes or something like that. Those are just rationalizations for our own insecurities, and don't behoove us to listen to. There's another weird mitzvah, another difficult mitzvah in this week's parasha that is itself becomes subject to strange rationalizations. So the ben sorer umoreh, the wayward or defiant son who may have been a glutton or a drunkard, and what that really meant. I hope this is my own water. Okay. You have these, it's a very weird and painful mitzvah that if your son is a miscreant, a delinquent, you can call the town together and effectively sentence him to capital punishment for being a bad child. As glorious as that sounds to someone with several boys at home, it's a very bad idea for family law. And by the time of our sages, let's say centuries or even a millennia later, they understood that this was a terrible idea, and they hoped in their hearts that it was null and void. They couldn't swallow that there was a piece of Torah that effectively advocated infanticide for small crimes. You know, if you have a son who drinks too much, you can kill him. If he doesn't listen to you, you can kill him. It sounds untoward and unseemly. It is itself an ervat davar. So by the time of our sages in Talmud, they redacted and restricted the law, and I'll read that to you a little. So the Talmud in Sanhedrin says the parents have to bring him to court, the father wants to declare the child wayward and disobedient, and the mother doesn't want to, or if one wants but the other doesn't want to, you can't apply the law. And it has to be unusual amounts of meat and wine, that is to say, being drunken and a glutton isn't enough, but you have to eat and consume certain things, thereby again restricting the application of the law. And then they eventually come to the conclusion that this never really happened. So why was it written? It was written so that you should study it and learn from it and discern law and discern God's will, but not that you should actually enact it, whereas one dissenting rabbi says, no, I did see this happen. The efforts they're making, and you see this around all sorts of capital punishment, is to restrict and reduce the width of the law. There's a proper legal term. Ken, want to help me? Breadth, but there's where it can be applied, the application of the law. Because it made them uncomfortable, frankly. The Torah seems like, well, if not bloodthirsty, then at least extremely, excessively strict. So they said, you know, let's make it less likely to happen. But in itself, it was the rabbi's effort to, if not whitewash the tradition, then at least to make rationalizations for it. We talked about this in the Beit Midrash, that Jacob and David seem very ambiguous or ambivalent characters. They are not holy good or holy evil. But by the time of our sages, they make Jacob into a saint and David into a scholar because they were uncomfortable with that kind of ambiguity. That's a kind of rationalization. If you can't accept and see the world as it is, and see the world as having unfairness and awkwardness and ambivalence, and can't tolerate a certain amount of hypocrisy, you're not really an adult. 16-year-olds have a really low threshold for hypocrisy, but when you come to be an adult, you realize that's just the grayness, the ambiguity of life. That's the way life is. So another kind of rationalization that the Torah notes this week is the rationalization of mitzvot, that some of them seem to have merit, some don't. Some are told you'll get long life out of them. Some it's not clear what the reward is. So our sages in Midrash point out that one should not think too heavily about what the value of one mitzvah is relative to another. And you shouldn't say, this mitzvah looks like a really important one, I'll do it and do it well. This mitzvah looks like a minor one, I'm not going to do it. Like the thief in Zusha's story, well, it did apply to the sermon. You do the minor things just like you do the major things. Life has a lot of grunt work. Life has a lot of little things that you might not enjoy. I mean, I'm terrible at this. You can't just focus on the big picture. You also have to do the trees, not just the forest. And you can't just do the things you love. You have to do the things that your kids need or the things that are required in the office. That's the way life is. You can't rationalize it away. So in the Midrash, it says that's why God doesn't tell us what mitzvot are worth, because we think about too much about the accounting and we give favor to the ones that seem more heavily weighted. So how do you achieve a week without rationalizations, to go back to the big chill? I mean, where would you find 7 consecutive days without rationalizations? What are some of the tricks? Well, I would start with the mental health diagnosis. Scott Peck, one of the writers in 12-step groups and on mental health, says that mental health is an ongoing process of dedication to reality at all costs. We used to, when I worked at Beit Shuva at the drug and alcohol rehab for Jews in Los Angeles, it was a Jewish drug and alcohol rehab, it wasn't for Jews exclusively. We used to start with everyone asking the question, what are the lies you tell yourself? So I was about 32 when I had to do this, and I thought, I don't know, how would I know what lies I'm telling myself? That seems impossible to say in print. 10 years later, I know plenty of the lies I tell myself. I figured out quite a few of them. And I think with life, we figure those out. That's the point. That's the dedication to reality at all costs that we impose upon ourselves if we're wise as we go through life. That these rationalizations, I did it because my wife doesn't love me. I did it because my parents weren't good enough. I did it because everyone does it. I can get away with it. They don't work. They ultimately undermine us. Being as bad as the next person isn't much of a good standard of morality. So we're told 2 things in this week's parasha, 2 specific mitzvot that help us, guide us in this absolute quest for reality. The Economist, its tagline of the newspaper is dedicated in the fight for information. In truth, seek out truth. So we're told to remember Amalek, not to forget him, to blot him out, to be clear and crystalline and strict in our memory, in our vision. Much like in the parsha of Balak, Bilam says, I'm prostrate and with eyes unveiled. And we're also told that when you see the poor, you can't remain indifferent. The word they use is hitalem, which means to disappear oneself, to close one's eyes, to be numb, to be dumb in the face of such things. You have to remember, you have to work, you have to notice, you have to keep your eyes clear. It's not easy. Rashi says that when you try to remain in a different way, you're really doing is closing your eyes and forcing them closed, to conquering what you see through the force of will. Be real. You've got 2+ weeks to get ready for Rosh Hashanah, and maybe you want to rededicate yourself to reality at all costs this year by keeping your eyes open, by keeping your memory firm, by being clear about what's ahead of you and not committing the errors of rationalizations. I don't know if you could get a whole week, but maybe you could string a day or two together without rationalizations.